Chapter 6 There was snow on Shreve's overcoat sleeve, his ungloved blonde square hand red and raw with cold, vanishing. Then on the table before Quentin, lying on the open textbook beneath the lamp, the white oblong of envelope, the familiar blurred mechanical Jefferson Jan 10, 1910 miss, and then opened the My Dear Son, in his father's sloped fine hand, out of that dead dusty summer where he had prepared for Harvard so that his father's hand could lie on the strange lamp-lit table in Cambridge. That dead summer twilight, the wisteria, the cigar smell, the fireflies, attenuated up from Mississippi and into this strange room, across this strange iron New England snow. My dear son, Miss Rosa Coldfield was buried yesterday. She remained in the coma for almost 2 weeks, and 2 days ago she died without regaining consciousness and without pain, they say. And whatever they mean by that, since it has always seemed to me that the only painless death must be that which takes the intelligence by violent surprise, and from the rear, so to speak, since if death be anything at all beyond a brief and peculiar emotional state of the bereaved, it must be a brief and likewise peculiar state of the subject as well, and if aught can be more painful to any intelligence above that of a child or an idiot than a slow and gradual confronting with that which over a long period of bewilderment and dread it has been taught to regard as an irrevocable and unplumbable finality, I do not know it. And if there can be either access of comfort or cessation of pain in the ultimate escape from a stubborn and amazed outrage which over a period of 43 years has been companionship and bread and fire and all, I do not know that either. Bringing with it that very September evening itself, and he soon needing, required, to say, no, neither aunt, cousin, nor uncle Rosa, Miss Rosa, Miss Rosa Coldfield, an old lady that died young of outrage in 1866 one summer. And then Shreve, you mean she was no kin to you? No kin to you at all? That there was actually one Southern Bayard or Guinevere who was no kin to you? Then what did she die for? And that not Shreve's first time, nobody's first time in Cambridge since September. Tell about the South. What's it like there? What do they do there? Why do they live there? Why do they live at all? That very September evening, when Mr. Compson stopped talking at last, he, Quentin, walked out of his father's talking at last, because it was now time to go. Not because he had heard it all, because he had not been listening, since he had something which he still was unable to pass. That door, that gaunt, tragic, dramatic, self-hypnotized, youthful face, like the tragedian in a college play, an academic Hamlet waked from some trancement of the curtains falling, and blundering across the dusty stage from which the rest of the cast had departed last commencement. The sister facing him across the wedding dress, which she was not to use, not even to finish. The two of them slashing at one another with 12 or 14 words, and most of these the same words repeated 2 or 3 times, so that when you boiled it down they did it with 8 or 10. And she, Miss Coldfield, had on the shawl, as he had known she would, and the bonnet, black once but faded now to that fierce, muted, metallic green of old peacock feathers, and the black reticule almost as large as a carpet-bag containing all the keys which the house possessed, cupboard, closet, and door, some of which would not even turn in locks which, shot home, could be solved by any child with a hairpin or a wad of chewing gum. Some of which no longer even fit the locks they had been made for, like old married people who no longer have anything in common to do or to talk about, save the same general weight of air to displace and breathe, and general oblivious biding earth to bear their weight. That evening, the 12 miles behind the fat mare in the moonless September dust, the trees along the road not rising soaring, as trees should, but squatting like huge fowl, their leaves ruffled and heavily separate like the feathers of panting fowls, heavy with 60 days of dust, the roadside undergrowth coated with heat-vulcanized dust, and, seen through the dust cloud in which the horse and buggy moved, appeared like masses stranding delicate and rigid and immobly upward at perpendiculars absolute, in some old dead volcanic water, refined to the oxygenless first principle of liquid. The dust cloud in which the buggy moved, not blowing away because it had been raised by no wind and was supported by no air, but evoked, materialized about them, instantaneous and eternal. Cubic foot for cubic foot of dust, to cubic foot of horse and buggy. Peripatetic beneath the branch-shredded vistas of flat, black, fiercely and heavily starred sky. The dust cloud moving on, enclosing them with not threat exactly, but maybe warning, bland, almost friendly warning, as if to say, come on if you like, but I will get there first. Accumulating ahead of you, I will arrive first, lifting, sloping gently upward under hooves and wheels, so that you will find no destination but will merely abrupt gently onto a plateau and a panorama of harmless and inscrutable night, and there will be nothing for you to do but return, and so I would advise you not to go, to turn back now and let what is be. He, Quentin, agreeing to this, sitting in the buggy beside the implacable doll-sized old woman clutching her cotton umbrella, smelling the heat-distilled old woman flesh, the heat-distilled camphor in the old fold creases of the shawl, feeling exactly like an electric bulb, blood and skin, since the buggy disturbed not enough air to cool him with motion, created not enough motion within him to make his skin sweat, thinking, good Lord, yes, let's don't find him or it, try to find him or it, risk disturbing him or it. Then Shreve again, wait, wait. You mean that this old gal, this Aunt Rosa... Miss Rosa, Quentin said. All right, all right. That this old dame, this Aunt Rosa... Miss Rosa, I tell you. All right, all right, all right. That this old... This Aunt Ro... All right, all right, all right, all right. That hadn't been out there, hadn't set foot in the house even in 43 years, yet who not only said there was somebody hidden in it, but found somebody that would believe her... Would drive that 12 miles out there in a buggy at midnight to see if she was right or not? Yes, Quentin said. That this old dame that grew up in a household like an overpopulated mausoleum, with no call or claim on her time but the hating of her father and aunt and her sister's husband in peace and comfort, and waiting for the day when they would prove not only to themselves but to everybody else that she had been right. So one night the aunt slid down the rainpipe with a horse trader, and she was right about the aunt. So that fixed that. Then her father nailed himself up in the attic to keep from being drafted into the rebel army and starved to death, so that fixed that, except for the unavoidable possibility that when the moment came for him to admit to himself that she had been right, he may not have been able to speak or may not have had anyone to tell it to. So she was right about the father, too, since if he hadn't made General Lee and Jeff Davis mad, he wouldn't have had to nail himself up and die. And if he hadn't died, he wouldn't have left her an orphan and a pauper and so situated, left susceptible to a situation where she could receive this mortal affront. And write about the brother-in-law, because if he hadn't been a demon, his children wouldn't have needed protection from him, and she wouldn't have had to go out there and be betrayed by the old meat, and find instead of a widowed Agamemnon to her Cassandra, an ancient stiff-jointed Pyramus to her eager though untried Thisbe, who could approach her in this unbidden April's compounded demonry and suggest that they breed together for test and sample, and if it was a boy they would marry. Would not have had to be blown back to town on the initial blast of that horror and outrage to eat of gall and wormwood stolen through paling fences at dawn. So this was not fixed at all and forever, because she couldn't even tell it because of who her successor was. Not because he found a successor by just turning around and no day's loss of time even, but because of who the successor was, that she might conceivably have ever suffered a situation where she could or would have to decline any office which her successor could have been deemed worthy, even by a demon, to fill. This not fixed at all, since when the moment came for him to admit he had been wrong, she would have the same trouble with him she had with her father. He would be dead too, since she doubtless foresaw the scythe, if for no other reason than that it would be the final outrage and affront, like the hammer and nails in her father's business. That scythe, symbolic laurel of a Caesar's triumph, that rusty scythe loaned by the demon himself to Jones more than 2 years ago to cut the weeds away from the shanty doorway to smooth the path for rutting, that rusty blade garlanded with each successive day's gaudy ribbon or cheap bead for the, how did she put it? Slut wasn't all, was it? To walk in, that scythe beyond whose symbolic shape he, even though dead, even when earth itself declined any longer to bear his weight, jeered at her? Yes, Quentin said. That this Faustus, this demon, this Beelzebub, fled hiding from some momentary flashy glare of his creditor's outraged face, exasperated beyond all endurance, hiding, scuttling into respectability like a jackal into a rock pile. So she thought at first, until she realized that he was not hiding, did not want to hide, was merely engaged in one final frenzy of evil and harm-doing before the creditor overtook him this next time for good and all. This Faustus, who appeared suddenly one Sunday with 2 pistols and 20 subsidiary demons, and skull-dugged 100 miles of land out of a poor ignorant Indian and built the biggest house on it you ever saw, and went away with 6 wagons and came back with the crystal tapestries and the Wedgwood chairs to furnish it, and nobody knew if he had robbed another steamboat or had just dug up a little more of the old loot, who hid horns and tail beneath human raiment and a beaver hat, and chose, bought her, outswapped his father-in-law, wasn't it? A wife after 3 years to scrutinize, weigh, and compare. Not from one of the local ducal houses, but from the lesser baronage whose principality was so far decayed that there would be no risk of his wife bringing him for dowry delusions of grandeur before he should be equipped for it. Yet not so far decayed, but that she might keep them both from getting lost among the new knives and forks and spoons that he had bought. A wife who not only would consolidate the hiding, but could, would, and did breed him 2 children to fend and shield, both in themselves and in their progeny, the brittle bones and tired flesh of an old man against the day when the creditor would run him to earth for the last time, and he couldn't get away. And so sure enough the daughter fell in love, the son the agent for the providing of that living bulwark between him, the demon, and the creditor's bailiff hand, until the son should marry and thus ensure him doubled and compounded. And then the demon must turn square around and run not only the fiancée out of the house and not only the son out of the house, but so corrupt, seduce, and mesmerize the son that he, the son, should do the office of the outraged father's pistol hand when fornication threatened, so that the demon should return from the war 5 years later and find accomplished and complete the situation he had been working for. Son fled for good now with a noose behind him, daughter doomed to spinsterhood. And then, almost before his foot was out of the stirrup, he, the demon, set out and got himself engaged again in order to replace that progeny the hopes of which he had himself destroyed? Yes, Quentin said. Came back home and found his chances of descendants gone where his children had attended to that, and his plantation ruined, fields fallow except for a fine stand of weeds, and taxes and levies and penalties sowed by United States marshals and such, and all his niggers gone where the Yankees had attended to that, and you would have thought he would have been satisfied. Yet before his foot was out of the stirrup, he not only set out to try to restore his plantation to what it used to be, like maybe he was hoping to fool the creditor by illusion and obfuscation, by concealing behind the illusion that time and change had not elapsed and occurred, the fact that he was now almost 60 years old, until he could get himself a new batch of children to bulwark him, but chose for this purpose the last woman on earth he might have hoped to prevail on, this Aunt Ru— All right. That hated him, that had always hated him, yet choosing her with a kind of outrageous bravado, as if a kind of despairing conviction of his irresistibility or invulnerability were a part of the price he had got for whatever it was he had sold the creditor, since according to the old dame he never had had a soul. Proposed to her and was accepted. Then 3 months later, with no date ever set for the wedding and marriage itself not mentioned 1 time since, and on the very day when he established definitely that he would be able to keep at least some of his land and how much, he approached her and suggested they breed like a couple of dogs together, inventing with fiendish cunning the thing which husbands and fiancés have been trying to invent for 10 million years, the thing that, without harming her or giving her grounds for civil or tribal action, would not only blast the little dream woman out of the dovecote, but leave her irrevocably husbanded, and himself, husband or fiancé, already safely cuckolded before she can draw breath, with the abstract carcass of outrage and revenge. Who said it and was free now, forevermore now, of threat or meddling from anyone, since he had at last eliminated the last member of his late wife's family. Free now. Son fled to Texas or California or maybe even South America. Daughter doomed to spinsterhood to live until he died. Since after that it wouldn't matter, in that rotting house, caring for him and feeding him, raising chickens and peddling the eggs for the clothes she and Clytie couldn't make. So that he didn't even need to be a demon now, but just mad, impotent old man who had realized at last that his dream of restoring his Sutphen's Hundred was not only vain, but that what he had left of it would never support him and his family, and so running his little crossroads store with a stock of plowshares and hamstrings and calico and kerosene and cheap beads and ribbons, and a clientele of freed niggers and, what is it, the word, white what? Yes, trash. With Jones for clerk, and who knows maybe what delusions of making money out of the store to rebuild the plantation. Who had escaped twice now, got himself into it, and been freed by the creditor who set his children to destroying one another before he had posterity. And he decided that maybe he was wrong in being free, and so got into it again, and then decided that he was wrong in being unfree, and so got out of it again. And then turned right around and bought his way back into it with beads and calico and striped candy out of his own showcase and off his shelves? Yes, Quentin said. He sounds just like Father, he thought, glancing, his face quiet, reposed, curiously almost sullen, for a moment at Shreve leaning forward into the lamp, his naked torso pink gleaming and baby smooth, cherubic, almost hairless, the twin moons of his spectacles glinting against his moon-like rubicund face, smelling, Quentin, the cigar and the wisteria, seeing the fireflies blowing and winking in the September dusk. Just exactly like Father, if Father had known as much about it the night before I went out there as he did the day after I came back. Thinking, mad, impotent old man who realized at last that there must be some limit even to the capabilities of a demon for doing harm. Who must have seen his situation as that of the showgirl, the pony, who realizes that the principal tune she prances to comes not from horn and fiddle and drum, but from a clock and calendar. Must have seen himself as the old worn-out cannon, which realizes that it can deliver just one more fierce shot and crumble to dust in its own furious blast and recoil. Who looked about upon the scene which was still within his scope and compass, and saw sun gone, vanished, more insuperable to him now than if the son were dead, since now, if the son still lived, his name would be different, and those to call him by it strangers, and whatever dragon's outcroppin' of Sutphen blood the son might sow on the body of whatever strange woman would therefore carry on the tradition, accomplish the hereditary evil and harm under another name, and upon and among people who will never have heard the right one. Daughter doomed to spinsterhood, who had chosen spinsterhood already before there was anyone named Charles Bond, since the aunt who came to succor her in bereavement and sorrow found neither, but instead that calm, absolutely impenetrable face between a homespun dress and sunbonnet, seen before a closed door, and again in a cloudy swirl of chickens while Jones was building the coffin, and which she wore during the next year while the aunt lived there, and the three women wove their own garments and raised their own food and cut the wood they cooked it with, excusing what help they had from Jones, who lived with his granddaughter in the abandoned fishing camp with its collapsing roof and rotten porch, against which the rusty scythe which Sutphen was to lend him make him borrow to cut away the weeds from the door, and at last forced him to use, though not to cut weeds, at least not vegetable weeds, would lean for 2 years, and wore still after the aunt's indignation had swept her back to town to live on stolen garden truck and out of anonymous baskets left on her front steps at night. The three of them, the two daughters, negro and white, and the aunt 12 miles away, watching from her distance as the two daughters watched from theirs, the old demon, the ancient varicose and despairing Faustus, fling his final mane now with the creditor's hand already on his shoulder. Running his little country store now for his bread and meat, haggling tediously over nickels and dimes with rapacious and poverty-stricken whites and negroes, who at one time would have galloped for 10 miles in any direction without crossing his own boundary, using out of his meager stock the cheap ribbons and beads and the stale, violently colored candy with which even an old man can seduce a 15-year-old country girl, to ruin the granddaughter of his partner, this Jones, this gangling, malaria-ridden white man whom he had given permission 14 years ago to squat in the abandoned fishing camp with the year-old grandchild. Jones, partner, porter, and clerk, who at the demon's command removed with his own hand, and maybe delivered too, from the showcase, the candy beads and ribbons, measured the very cloth from which Judith, who had not been bereaved and did not mourn, helped the granddaughter to fashion a dress to walk past the lounging men in, the side looking in the tongues, until her increasing belly taught her embarrassment, or perhaps fear. Jones, who before 61 had not even been allowed to approach the front of the house, and who during the next 4 years got no nearer than the kitchen door, and that only when he brought the game and fish and vegetables on which the seducer-to-be's wife and daughter, and Clytie too, the one remaining servant, negro, the one who would forbid him to pass the kitchen door with what he brought, depended on to keep life in them, but who now entered the house itself on the quite frequent now afternoons when the demon would suddenly curse the store empty of customers and lock the door and repair to the rear, and in the same tone in which he used to address his orderly or even his house servants when he had them, and in which he doubtless ordered Jones to fetch from the showcase the ribbons and beads and candy, direct Jones to fetch the jug. The two of them, and Jones even sittin' now, who in the old days, the old dead Sunday afternoons of monotonous peace, which they spent beneath the scuppernong arbor in the backyard, the demon lying in the hammock while Jones squatted against a post, rising from time to time to pour for the demon from the demijohn and the bucket of spring water which he had fetched from the spring more than a mile away, then squatting again, chortling and chuckling and saying, "Sure, Mr. Tom," each time the demon paused. The two of them drink and turn and turn about from the jug, and the demon not lying down now, nor even sitting, but reaching after the third or second drink, that old man's state of impotent and furious undefeat, in which he would rise, swaying and plunging and shouting for his horse and pistols to ride single-handed into Washington and shoot Lincoln, a year or so too late here, and Sherman both, shouting, "Kill them! Shoot them down like the dogs they are!" And Jones, "Sure, Colonel, sure now," and catching him as he fell and commandeering the first passing wagon to take him to the house and carry him up the front steps and through the paintless formal door beneath its fanlight imported pane by pane from Europe, which Judith held open for him to enter with no change, no alteration in that calm, frozen face which she had worn for 4 years now, and on up the stairs and into the bedroom and put him to bed like a baby and then lie down himself on the floor beside the bed, though not to sleep, since before dawn the man on the bed would stir and groan, and Jones would say, "Here I am, Colonel. It's all right. They ain't whooped us yet, air they?" This Jones, who after the demon rode away with the regiment when the granddaughter was only 8 years old, would tell people that he was looking after Major's place and niggers, even before they had time to ask why he was not with the troops, and perhaps in time came to believe the lie himself, who was among the first to greet the demon when he returned, to meet him at the gate and say, "Well, Colonel, they killed us, but they ain't whooped us yet, air they?" Who even worked, labored, sweat at the demon's behest during that first furious period, while the demon believed he could restore by sheer indomitable willin' the Sutpen's hundred which he remembered and had lost, labored with no hope of pay or reward, who must have seen long before the demon did, or would admit it, that the task was hopeless. Blind Jones, who apparently saw still in that furious, lecherous wreck, the old fine figure of the man who once galloped on the black thoroughbred about that domain, two boundaries of which the eye could not see from any point. "Yes," Quentin said.
This book is continued on Disc 6.
"Yes," Quentin said. So that Sunday morning came, and the demon up and away before dawn, Judah thinking she knew why, since that morning the black stallion which he rode to Virginia and led back had a son born on his wife Penelope, only it was not that foal which the demon had got up early to look at, and it was almost a week before they caught, found the old negress, the midwife who was squatting beside the quilt pallet that dawn while Jones sat on the porch where the rusty scythe had leaned for 2 years, so that she could tell how she heard the horse, and then the demon entered and stood over the pallet with the riding whip in his hand and looked down at the mother and the child and said, "Well, Millie, too bad you're not a mare like Penelope. Then I could give you a decent stall in the stable." And turned and went out, and the old negress squatted there and heard them, the voices, he and Jones. "Stand back, don't you touch me, Wash. I'm going to tetch you, Colonel." And she heard the whip, too, though not the scythe. No whistling air, no blow, nothing, since always that which merely consummates punishment evokes a cry, while that which evokes the last silence occurs in silence. And that night they finally found him and fetched him home in a wagon and carried him, quiet and bloody and with his teeth still showing in his parted beard, which was hardly grizzled, although his hair was almost white now, in the light of the lanterns and the pine torches, up the steps where the tearless and stone-faced daughter held the door open for him, too, who used to like to drive fast to church, and who rode fast there this time. Only when it was all over he had never reached the church, since the daughter, the woman of 30 now and looking older, not as the weak grow old, either enclosed in a static ballooning of already lifeless flesh, or through a series of stages of gradual collapsing, whose particles adhere not to some iron and still impervious framework, but to one another as though in some communal and oblivious and mindless life of their own like a colony of maggots. But as the demon himself had grown old, with a kind of condensation, an anguished emergence of the primary indomitable ossification which the soft color and texture, the light electric aura of youth, had merely temporarily assuaged but never concealed. The spinster in homemade and shapeless clothing, with hands which could either transfer eggs or hold a plow straight in furrow, decided that he should be driven into that same Methodist church in town where he had married her mother before returning to the grave in the cedar grove, who borrowed 2 half-wild young mules to pull the wagon. So he rode fast toward church as far as he went, in his homemade coffin, in his regimentals and saber and embroidered gauntlets, until the young mules bolted and turned the wagon over and tumbled him, saber plumes and all, into a ditch from which the daughter extricated him and fetched him back to the cedar grove and read the service herself. And no tears, no bereavement this time too, whether or not it was because she had no time to mourn, since she ran the store herself now until she found a buyer for it, not keeping it open but carrying the keys to it in her apron pocket, hailed from the kitchen or the garden or even from the field, since she and Clytie now did all the ploughing which was done, now that Jones was gone too, having followed the demon within 12 hours on that same Sunday, and maybe to the same place, maybe they would even have a scuppernong vine for them and no compulsions now of bread or ambition or fornication or vengeance, and maybe they wouldn't even have to drink, only they would miss this now and then without knowing what it was that they missed, but not often. Serene, pleasant, unmarked by time or change of weather, only just now and then something, a wind, a shadow, and the demon would stop talking and Jones would stop guffawing, and they would look at one another, groping, grave, intent, and the demon would say, "What was it, Wash? Something happened. What was it?" And Jones looking at the demon, groping too, sober too, saying, "I don't know, Colonel. What?" Each watching the other. Then the shadow would fade, the wind die away, until at last Jones would say, serene, not even triumphant, "They mout have killed us, but they ain't whooped us yet, air they?" Hailed by women and children with pails and baskets, whereupon she or Clytie would go to the store, unlock it, serve the customer, lock the store, and return, until she sold the store at last and spent the money for a tombstone. "How was it?" Shreve said. "You told me. How was it? You and your father shooting quail, the gray day after it had rained all night, and the ditch the horses wouldn't cross, so you and your father got down and gave the reins to, what was his name, the nigger on the mule? Luster. Luster to lead them around the ditch. And he and his father crossed just as the rain began to come down again, gray and solid and slow, making no sound. Quentin, not aware yet of just where they were, because he had been riding with his head lowered against the drizzle. until he looked up the slope before them where the wet yellow sedge died upward into the rain like melting gold, and saw the grove, the clump of cedars on the crest of the hill dissolving into the rain as if the trees had been drawn in ink on a wet blotter. The cedars beyond which, beyond the ruined fields beyond which, would be the oak grove and the gray, huge, rotting, deserted house half a mile away. Mr. Compson had stopped to look back at Luster on the mule, the tow sack he had been using for saddle now wrapped around his head, his knees drawn up under it, leading the horses on down the ditch to find a place to cross. "Better get on out of the rain," Mr. Compson said. "He's not going to come within 100 yards of those cedars anyway." They went on up the slope. They could not see the two dogs at all, only the steady furrowing of the sedge where, invisible, the dogs quartered the slope until one of them flung up his head to look back. Mr. Compson gestured with his hand toward the trees, he and Quentin following. It was dark among the cedars, the light more dark than gray even, the quiet rain, the faint pearly globules materializing on the gun barrels and the 5 headstones, like drops of not-quite-congealed meltings from cold candles on the marble. The 2 flat, heavy vaulted slabs, the other 3 headstones leaning a little awry, with here and there a carved letter or even an entire word momentary and legible in the faint light which the raindrops brought particle by particle into the gloom and released. Now the 2 dogs came in, drifted in like smoke, their hair close plastered with damp, and curled down in 1 indistinguishable and apparently inextricable ball for warmth. Both the flat slabs were cracked across the middle by their own weight, and vanishing into the hole where the brick coping of 1 vault had fallen in was a smooth, faint path worn by some small animal, possum probably, by generations of some small animal, since there could have been nothing to eat in the grave for a long time. Though the lettering was quite legible. Ellen Coldfield Sutphen, born October 9, 1817, died January 23, 1863. And the other, Thomas Sutphen, Colonel, 23rd Mississippi Infantry, CSA, died August 12, 1869. This last, the date added later, crudely with a chisel, who even dead did not divulge where and when he had been born. Quentin looked at the stones quietly, thinking, "Not beloved wife of?" No. Ellen Coldfield Sutphen. "I wouldn't have thought they would have had any money to buy marble with in 1869," he said. "He bought them himself," Mr. Compson said. "He bought the 2 of them while the regiment was in Virginia, after Judith got word to him that her mother was dead. He ordered them from Italy, the best, the finest to be had, his wife's complete and his with the date left blank. And this while on active service with an army which had not only the highest mortality rate of any before or since, but which had a custom of electing a new set of regimental officers each year, and by which system he was at the moment entitled to call himself colonel, since he had been voted in and Colonel Sartoris voted out only last summer, so that for all he could know, before his order could be filled or even received, he might be already underground and his grave marked, if at all, by a shattered musket thrust into the earth. Or lacking that, he might be a 2nd lieutenant or even a private, provided, of course, that his men would have had the courage to demote him. Yet he not only ordered the stones and managed to pay for them, but stranger still, he managed to get them past a seacoast so closely blockaded that the incoming runners refused any cargo except ammunition. It seemed to Quentin that he could actually see them, the ragged and starving troops without shoes, the gaunt, powder-blackened faces looking backward over tattered shoulders, the glaring eyes in which burned some indomitable desperation of undefeat, watching that dark interdict ocean across which a grim, lightless, solitary ship fled within its hold 2,000 precious pounds space containing not bullets, not even something to eat, but that much bombastic and inert carven rock which for the next year was to be a part of the regiment, to follow it into Pennsylvania and be present at Gettysburg, moving behind the regiment in a wagon driven by the demon's body servant through swamp and plain and mountain pass. The regiment moving no faster than the wagon could, with starved gaunt men and gaunt spent horses knee-deep in icy mud or snow, sweating and cursing it through bog and morass like a piece of artillery, speaking of the two stones as Colonel and Mrs. Colonel. Then through the Cumberland Gap and down through the Tennessee Mountains, traveling at night to dodge Yankee patrols, and into Mississippi in the late fall of 64, where the daughter waited whose marriage he had interdicted and who was to be a widow the next summer, though apparently not bereaved, where his wife was dead and his son self-excommunicated and banished, and put one of the stones over his wife's grave and set the other upright in the hall of the house, where Miss Coldfield possibly, maybe doubtless, looked at it every day as though it were his portrait, possibly, maybe doubtless here too, reading among the lettering more of maiden hope and virgin expectation than she ever told Quentin about, since she never mentioned the stone to him at all, and the demon drank the parched corn coffee and ate the hoe cake which Judith and Clytie prepared for him, and kissed Judith on the forehead and said, "Well, Clytie," and returned to the war, all in 24 hours. He could see it. He might even have been there. Then he thought, "No, if I had been there, I could not have seen it this plain." "But that don't explain the other three," he said. "They must have cost something, too." "Who would have paid for them?" Mr. Compson said. Quentin could feel him looking at him. "Think." Quentin looked at the three identical headstones with their faint identical lettering, slanted a little in the soft loamy decay of accumulated cedar needles, these decipherable too when he looked close. The first one, "Charles Bond, born in New Orleans, Louisiana, died at Sutphen's Hundred, Mississippi, May 3, 1865. Aged 33 years and 5 months." He could feel his father watching him. "She did it," he said, "with that money she got when she sold the store." "Yes," Mr. Compson said. Quentin had to stoop and brush away some of the cedar needles to read the next one. As he did so, one of the dogs rose and approached him, thrusting its head in to see what he was looking at like a human being would. As if from association with human beings it had acquired the quality of curiosity which is an attribute only of men and apes. "Get away," he said, thrusting the dog back with one hand, while with the other he brushed the cedar needles away, smoothing with his hand into legibility the faint lettering, the graved words. "Charles Etienne Saint-Valery Bon, 1859-1884. Feeling his father was watching him, remarking before he rose that the third stone bore that same date, 1884. "It couldn't have been the store this time," he said, "because she sold the store in 70, and besides, 1884 is the same date that's on hers." Thinking how it would have been terrible for her, sure enough, if she had wanted to put "beloved husband of" on that first one. "Ah," Mr. Compson said, "that was the one your grandfather attended to. Judith came into town one day and brought him the money. Some of it. Where she got it from he never knew, unless it was what she had left out of the price of the store, which he sold for her. Brought the money in with the inscription, except the date of death, of course, all written out as you see it, during that 3 weeks while Clytie was in New Orleans finding the boy to fetch him back, though your grandfather, of course, did not know this. Money and inscription not for herself, but for him." "Oh," Quentin said. "Yes, they lead beautiful lives, women. Lives not only divorced from, but irrevocably excommunicated from, all reality. That's why, although their deaths, the instant of dissolution, are of no importance to them, since they have a courage and fortitude in the face of pain and annihilation, which would make the most Spartan man resemble a Puelan boy, yet to them their funerals and graves, the little puny affirmations of spurious immortality set above their slumber, are of incalculable importance. You had an aunt once, you do not remember her because I never saw her myself but only heard the tale, who was faced with a serious operation, which she became convinced she would not survive, at a time when her nearest female kin was a woman between whom and herself there had existed for years one of those bitter, inexplicable, to the man mind, amicable enmities which occur between women of the same blood, whose sole worry about departing this world was to get rid of a certain brown dress which she owned and knew that the kinswoman knew she had never liked, which must be burned, not given away but burned in the backyard beneath the window where, by being held up to the window and suffering excruciating pain, she could see it burned with her own eyes, because she was convinced that after she died, the kinswoman, the logical one to take charge, would bury her in it. "And did she die?" Quentin said. "No. As soon as the dress was consumed, she began to mend. She stood the operation and recovered and outlived the kinswoman by several years. Then one afternoon she died peacefully of no particular ailment and was buried in her wedding gown."
"Oh," Quentin said.
"Yes, but there was one afternoon in the summer of 70 when one of these graves, there were only three here then, was actually watered by tears. Your grandfather saw it. That was the year Judith sold the store, and your grandfather attended to it for her, and he had ridden out to see her about the matter, and he witnessed it. The interlude, the ceremonial widowhood's bright dramatic pageantry. He didn't know at the time how the Octoroon came to be here, how Judith could even have known about her to write her where Bond was dead. But there she was, with the 11-year-old boy who looked more like 8. It must have resembled a garden scene by the Irish poet Wilde. The late afternoon, the dark cedars with the level sun in them, even the light exactly right, and the graves, the three pieces of marble. Your grandfather had advanced Judith the money to buy the third stone with against the price of the store, looking as though they'd been cleaned and polished and arranged by scene shifters who, with the passing of twilight, would return and strike them and carry them, hollow, fragile, and without weight, back to the warehouse until they should be needed again. The pageant, the scene, the act, entering upon the stage. The magnolia-faced woman, a little plumper now. A woman created of by and for darkness, whom the artist Beardsley might have dressed, in a soft, flowing gown designed not to infer bereavement or widowhood, but to dress some interlude of slumberous and fatal insatiation, of passionate and inexorable hunger of the flesh, walking beneath a lace parasol and followed by a bright, gigantic negress carrying a silk cushion and leading by the hand the little boy whom Beardsley might not only have dressed but drawn. A thin, delicate child with a smooth, ivory, sexless face who, after his mother handed the negress the parasol and took the cushion and knelt beside the grave and arranged her skirts and wept, never released the negress's apron, but stood blinking quietly, who, having been born and lived all his life in a kind of silken prison lighted by perpetual shaded candles, breathing for air the milk-like and absolutely physical lambence which his mother's days and hours emanated, had seen little enough of sunlight before, let alone out of doors, trees and grass and earth. And last of all, the other woman, Judith, who, not bereaved, did not need to mourn, Quentin thought, thinking, "Yes, I have had to listen too long," who stood just inside the cedars, in the calico dress and the sunbonnet to match it, both faded and shapeless, the calm face, the hands which could plow or cut wood and cook or weave cloth folded before her, standing in the attitude of an indifferent guide in a museum, waiting, probably not even watching. Then the negress came and handed the octoroon a crystal bottle to smell and helped her to rise, and took up the silk cushion and gave the octoroon the parasol, and they returned to the house, the little boy still holding to the negress's apron, the negress supporting the woman with one arm and Judith following with that face like a mask or like marble, back to the house, across the tall scale and portico, and into the house where Clytie was cooking the eggs and the cornbread on which she and Judith lived. She stayed a week. She passed the rest of that week in the one remaining room in the house whose bed had linen sheets. Passed it in bed, in the new lace and silk and satin negligees subdued to the mauve and lilac of morning. That room airless and shuttered, impregnated behind the sagging closed blinds with the heavy faint odor of her flesh, her days, her hours, her garments, of eau de cologne from the cloth upon her temples, of the crystal phial which the negress alternated with the fan as she sat beside the bed between trips to the door to receive the trays which Clytie carried up the stairs. Clytie, who did that fetching and carrying as Judith made her, who must have perceived, whether Judith told her or not, that it was another negro whom she served, yet who served the negress just as she would quit the kitchen from time to time and search the rooms downstairs until she found that little strange lonely boy sitting quietly on a straight hard chair in the dim and shadowy library or parlor,
with his four names and his 16th part black blood and his expensive esoteric Fauntleroy clothing, who regarded with an aghast, fatalistic terror the grim coffee-colored woman who would come on bare feet to the door and look in at him, who gave him not tea cakes but the coarsest cornbread spread with as coarse molasses, this surreptitiously, not that the mother or the duenna might object, but because the household did not have food for eating between meals, gave it to him, thrust it at him with restrained savageness, and who found him one afternoon playing with a negro boy about his own size in the road outside the gates, and cursed the negro child out of sight with level and deadly violence, and sent him, the other, back to the house in a voice the very absence from which a vituperation or rage made it seem just that much more deadly and cold. Yes, Clytie, who stood impassive beside the wagon on that last day, following the second ceremonial to the grave with the silk cushion and the parasol and the smelling bottle, when mother and child and duenna departed for New Orleans. And your grandfather never knew if it was Clytie who watched, kept in touch by some means, waited for the day, the moment, to come, the hour when the little boy would be an orphan, and so went herself to fetch him. Or if it was Judith who did the waitin' and the watchin' and sent Clytie for him that winter, that December of 1871. Clytie, who had never been further from Sutphen's Hundred than Jefferson in her life, yet who made that journey alone to New Orleans and returned with the child, the boy of 12 now and looking 10, in one of the outgrown Fauntleroy suits, but with a new oversized overall jumper coat which Clytie had bought for him, and made him wear, whether against the cold or whether not your grandfather could not say either, over it, and what else he owned tied up in a bandana handkerchief. This child, who could speak no English, as the woman could speak no French, who had found him, hunted him down, in a French city, and brought him away, this child with a face not old but without age, as if he had had no childhood, not in the sense that Miss Rosa Coldfield says she had no childhood, but as if he had not been human-born, but instead created without agency of man or agony of woman, and orphaned by no human being. Your grandfather said you did not wonder what had become of the mother, you did not even care, death or elopement or marriage, who would not grow from one metamorphosis, dissolution or adultery, to the next, carrying along with her all the old accumulated rubbish years which we call memory, the recognizable eye, but changing from phase to phase as the butterfly changes once the cocoon is cleared, carrying nothing of what was into what is, leaving nothing of what is behind but a laden complete and intact and unresistant into the next avatar, as the overblown rose or magnolia elides from one rich June to the next, leaving no bones, no substance, no dust of whatever dead pristine soulless rich surrender anywhere between sun and earth. But produced complete and subject to no microbe in that cloyed and scented maze of shuttered silk, as if he were the delicate and perverse spirit symbol, immortal page of the ancient immortal Lilith, entering the actual world not at the age of 1 second but of 12 years, the delicate garments of his pagehood already half concealed beneath that harsh and shapeless denim cut to an iron pattern and sold by the millions, that burlesque uniform and regalia of the tragic burlesque of the Sons of Ham. A slight, silent child who could not even speak English, picked suddenly up out of whatever debacle the only life he knew had disintegrated into, by a creature whom he had seen once and learned to dread and fear, yet could not flee, held helpless and passive in a state which must have been some incredible compound of horror and trust, since although he could not even talk to her, they must have made that week's journey by steamboat among the cotton bales on the freight deck, eating and sleeping with negroes, where he could not even tell his companion when he was hungry or when he had to relieve himself, and so could have only suspected, surmised, where she was taking him, could have known nothing certainly, except that all he had ever been familiar with was vanishing about him like smoke. Yet he made no resistance, returning quietly and docilely to that decaying house which he had seen one time, where the fierce, brooding woman who had come and got him lived with the calm white one who was not even fierce, who was not anything except calm, who to him did not even have a name yet, who was somehow so closely related to him as to be the owner of the one spot on earth where he had ever seen his mother weep. Returned, crossed that strange threshold, that irrevocable demarcation, not led, not dragged, but driven and herded by that stern, implacable presence, into that gaunt and barren household, where his very silken remaining clothes, his delicate shirt and stockings and shoes, which still remained to remind him of what he had once been, vanished, fled from arms and body and legs as if they had been woven of chimeras or of smoke. Yes, sleeping in the trundle bed beside Judith's, beside that of the woman who looked upon him and treated him with a cold, unbending, detached gentleness, more discouraging than the fierce, ruthless, constant guardianship of the negress who, with a sort of invincible, spurious humility, slept on a pallet on the floor. The child lying there between them, unasleep in some hiatus of passive and hopeless despair, aware of this, aware of the woman on the bed whose every look and action toward him, whose every touch of the capable hands seemed at the moment of touching his body to lose all warmth and become imbued with cold, implacable antipathy, and the woman on the pallet upon whom he had already come to look as might some delicate, talonless, and fangless wild beast crouched in its cage in some hopeless and desperate similitude of ferocity. And your grandfather said, "Suffer little children to come unto me." And what did he mean by that? How, if he meant that little children should need to be suffered to approach him, what sort of earth had he created? That if they had to suffer in order to approach him, what sort of heaven did he have? Look upon the human creature who feeds it, who fed him, thrust food which he himself could discern to be the choicest of what they had, food which he realized had been prepared for him by deliberate sacrifice. With that curious blend of savageness and pity, of yearning and hatred, who dressed him and washed him, thrust him into tubs of water too hot or too cold, yet against which he dared make no outcry, and scrubbed him with harsh rags and soap, sometimes scrubbing at him with repressed fury as if she were trying to wash the smooth, faint olive tinge from his skin as you might watch a child scrubbing at a wall long after the epithet, the chalked insult, has been obliterated. Lying there unsleeping in the dark between them, feeling them unasleep too, feeling them thinking about him, projecting about him, and filling the thunderous solitude of his despair louder than speech could. You are not up here in this bed with me, where through no fault nor willing of your own you should be, and you are not down here on this pallet floor with me, where through no fault or willing of your own you must and will be, not through any fault or willing of our own, who would not what we cannot, just as we will and wait for what must be. And your grandfather did not know either just which of them it was who told him that he was, must be, a negro, who could neither have heard yet nor recognized the term nigger, who even had no word for it in the tongue he knew, who had been born and grown up in a padded silken vacuum cell, which might have been suspended on a cable 1,000 fathoms in the sea, where pigmentation had no more moral value than the silk walls and the scent and the rose-colored candle shades, where the very abstractions which he might have observed, monogamy and fidelity and decorum and gentleness and affection, were as purely rooted in the flesh's offices as the digestive processes. Your grandfather did not know if he was sent from the trundle bed at last, or if he quitted it by his own wish and will, if when the time came when his loneliness and grief became calloused, he retired himself from Judith's bedroom or was sent from it to sleep in the hall, where Clytie had likewise moved her pallet, though not on a pallet like her, but on a cot, elevated still, and perhaps not by Judith's decree either, but by the negress's fierce, inexorable, spurious humility. And then in the attic, the cot moved there, the few garments, the rags of the silk and broadcloth in which he had arrived, the harsh jeans and homespun which the two women bought and made for him, he accepting them with no thanks, no comment, accepting his garret room with no thanks, no comment, asking for and making no alteration in its spot and arrangements that they knew of until that second year when he was 14 and one of them, Clytie or Judith, found hidden beneath his mattress the shard of broken mirror, and who to know what hours of amazed and tearless grief he might have spent before it, examining himself in the delicate and outgrown tatters in which he perhaps could not even remember himself, with quiet and incredulous incomprehension. Hanging behind a curtain contrived of a piece of old carpet nailed across a corner. And Clytie, sleeping in the hall below, barring the foot of the attic stairs, guarding his escape or exit as inexorably as a Spanish duenna, teaching him to chop wood and to work the garden and then to plough as his strength, his resiliency, rather, since he would never be other than light in the bone and almost delicate, increased. The boy, with his light bones and womanish hands, struggling with what anonymous avatar of intractable mule, whatever tragic and barren clown was his bound fellow and complement beneath his first father's curse, getting the hang of it gradually, and the two of them, linked by the savage steel and wood male symbol, ripping from the prone rich female earth corn to feed them both, while Clytie watched, never out of sight of him, with that brooding, fierce, unflagging, jealous care, hurrying out whenever anyone, white or black, stopped in the road as if to wait for the boy to complete the furrow and pause long enough to be spoken to, sending the boy on with a single quiet word or even gesture, 100 times more fierce than the level murmur of vituperation with which she drove the passerby on. So he, your grandfather, believed that it was neither of them, not Clytie, who guarded him as if he were a Spanish virgin, who even before she could have even suspected that he would ever come to live there, had interrupted his first contact with a nigger and sent him back to the house. Not Judith, who could have refused at any time to let him sleep in that white child's bed in her room, who even if she could not have reconciled herself to his sleeping on the floor, could have forced Clytie to take him into another bed with her, who would have made a monk, a celibate of him perhaps, yet not a eunuch, who may not have permitted him to pass himself for a foreigner, yet who certainly would not have driven him to consort with negroes. Your grandfather didn't know, even though he did know more than the town, the countryside knew, which was that there was a strange little boy living out there who had apparently emerged from the house for the first time at the age of about 12 years, whose presence was not even unaccountable to the town and county, since they now believed they knew why Henry had shot Bond, and they wondered only where and how Clytie and Judith had managed to keep him concealed all the time, believing now that it had been a widow who had buried Bond, even though she had no paper to show for it, and only the incredulous and shocked speculation of your grandfather, who, though he had that $100 and the written directions in Judith's hand for this fourth tombstone in his safe at the time, had not yet associated the boy with the child he had seen 2 years ago when the octoroon came there to weep at the grave, to believe that the child might be Clytie's, got by its father on the body of his own daughter, a boy seen always near the house with Clytie always nearby, then a youth learning to plough and Clytie somewhere nearby too, and it soon well known with what grim and unflagging alertness she discovered and interrupted any attempt to speak to him. And only your grandfather to couple at last the boy, the youth, with the child who had been there 3 or 4 years ago to visit that grave. Your grandfather, to whose office Judith came that afternoon 5 years later, and he could not remember when he had seen her in Jefferson before. The woman of 40 now, in the same shapeless calico and faded sunbonnet, who would not even sit down, who, despite the impenetrable mask which she used for face, emanated a terrible urgency, who insisted that they walk on toward the courthouse while she talked, told him, toward the crowded room where the justice's court sat. The crowded room which they entered, and your grandfather saw him, the boy, only a man now, handcuffed to an officer, his other arm in a sling and his head bandaged, since they had taken him to the doctor first, your grandfather gradually learning what had happened, or as much of it as he could, since the court itself couldn't get very much out of the witnesses, the ones who had fled and sent for the sheriff, the ones, except in that one whom he had injured too badly to be present, with whom he had fought. A negro ball held in a cabin a few miles from Sutpen's Hundred, and he there, present, and your grandfather never to know how often he had done this before, whether he had gone there to engage in the dancing or for the dice game in progress in the kitchen where the trouble started, trouble which he and not the negroes started, according to the witnesses, and for no reason. No accusation of cheating, nothing. And he making no denial, saying nothing, refusing to speak at all, sitting there sullen, pale, and silent. So that at this point all truth, evidence, vanished into a moiling clump of negro backs and heads and black arms and hands clutching sticks of stove wood and cooking implements and razors. The white man the focal point of it, and using a knife which he had produced from somewhere, clumsily, with obvious lack of skill and practice, yet with deadly earnestness and a strength which his slight build denied. A strength composed of sheer desperate will and imperviousness to the punishment, the blows and slashes which he took in return, and did not even seem to feel. No cause, no reason for it. None to ever know exactly what happened, what curses and ejaculations which might have indicated what it was that drove him, and only your grandfather to fumble, grope, grasp the presence of that furious protest, that indictment of heaven's ordering, that gauge flung into the face of what is, with a furious and indomitable desperation which the demon himself might have shown, as if the child and then the youth had acquired it from the walls in which the demon had lived, the air which he had once walked in and breathed, until that moment when his own fate, which he had dared in his turn, struck back at him. Only your grandfather to sense that because the justice and the others present did not recognize him, did not recognize this slight man with his bandaged head and arm, his sullen, impassive, and now bloodless olive face, who refused to answer any questions, make any statement, so that the justice, Jim Hamblett it was already making his speech of indictment when your grandfather entered, utilizing opportunity and audience to orate, his eyes already glazed with that cessation of vision of people who like to hear themselves talk in public. At this time, while our country is struggling to rise from beneath the iron heel of a tyrant oppressor, when the very future of the South as a place bearable for our women and children to live in depends on the labor of our own hands, when the tools which we have to use to depend on are the pride and integrity and forbearance of black men and the pride and integrity and forbearance of white, that you, I say, a white man, a white... And your grandfather trying to reach him, stop him, trying to push through the crowd, saying, "Jim, Jim, Jim!" And it already too late, as if Hamblett's own voice had waked him at last, or as if someone had snapped his fingers under his nose and waked him. He looking at the prisoner now, but saying white again, even while his voice died away, as if the order to stop the voice had been shocked into short circuit. And every face in the room turned toward the prisoner as Hamblett cried, "What are you? Who and where did you come from?" Your grandfather got him out, quashed the indictment, and paid the fine, and brought him back to his office and talked to him while Judith waited in the anteroom. "You are Charles Bond's son," he said. "I don't know," the other answered, harsh and sullen. "You don't remember?" your grandfather said. The other did not answer. Then your grandfather told him he must go away, disappear, giving him money to go on. "Whatever you are, once you are among strangers, people who don't know you, you can be whatever you will. I will make it all right. I will talk to... what do you call her?" And he had gone too far now, but it was too late to stop. He sat there and looked at that still face which had no more expression than Judith's, nothing of hope nor pain. Just sullen and inscrutable and looking down at the calloused womanish hands with their cracked nails, which held the money, while your grandfather thought how he could not say, "Miss Judith," since that would postulate the blood more than ever. Then he thought, "I don't even know whether he wants to hide it or not." So he said, "Miss Sutphen." "I will tell Miss Sutphen, not where you are gone, of course, because I won't know that myself, but just that you are gone, and that I knew you were gone, and that you will be all right." So he departed, and your grandfather rode out to tell Judith. And Clytie came to the door and looked full and steadily at his face, and said nothing, and went to call Judith, and your grandfather waited in that dim shrouded parlor, and knew that he would not have to tell either of them. He did not have to. Judith came presently and stood and looked at him and said, "I suppose you won't tell me." "Not won't, can't," your grandfather said. but not now because of any promise I made him. But he has money. He will be... And stopped, with that forlorn little boy invisible between them who had come there 8 years ago with the overall jumper over what remained of his silken broadcloth, who had become the youth in the uniform, the tattered hat and the overalls of his ancient curse, who had become the young man with the young man's potence, yet was still that lonely child in his parchment and denim hair shirt. And your grandfather speak in the lame vain words, the specious and empty fallacies which we call comfort, thinking better that he were dead, better that he had never lived. Then thinking what vain and empty recapitulation that would be to her if he were to say it, who doubtless had already said it, thought it, changed only the person and the number. He returned to town. And now, next time, he was not sent for. He learned it as the town learned it, by that country grapevine whose source is among Negroes. And he, Charles-Étienne Saint-Valery Bon, already returned, not home again, returned, before your grandfather learned how he had come back, appeared with a coal-black and ape-like woman and an authentic wedding license, brought back by the woman since he had been so severely beaten and mauled recently that he could not even hold himself on the spavined and saddleless mule on which he rode, while his wife walked beside it to keep him from falling off. Rode up to the house and apparently flung the wedding license in Judith's face with something of that invincible despair with which he had attacked the Negroes in the dice game. And none ever to know what incredible tale lay behind that year's absence, which he never referred to, and which the woman who, even a year later and after their son was born, still existed in that aghast and automaton-like state in which she had arrived, did not, possibly could not, recount, but which she seemed to exude gradually and by a process of terrific and incredulous excretion like the sweat of fear or anguish. How he had found her, dragged her out of whatever two-dimensional backwater, the very name of which, town or village, she either had never known or the shock of her exodus from it had driven the name forever from her mind and memory. Her mentality had been capable of coercing food and shelter from, and married her, held her very hand, doubtless, while she made the laborious cross on the register, before she even knew his name or knew that he was not a white man. And this last, none knew even now if she knew for certain, even after the son was born in one of the dilapidated slave cabins which he rebuilt after renting his parcel of land from Judith. How there followed something like a year composed of a succession of periods of utter immobility like a broken cinema film, which the white-colored man who had married her spent on his back recovering from the last maulin' he had received, in frowsy stinkin' rooms in places, towns and cities, which likewise had no names to her, broken by other periods, intervals of furious and incomprehensible and apparently reasonless movin', progression, a maelstrom of faces and bodies through which the man thrust, dragging her behind him, toward or from what, driven by what fury which would not let him rest, she did not know. Each one to end, finish as the one before it had, so that it was almost a ritual. The man apparently hunting out situations in order to flaunt and fling the ape-like body of his charcoal companion in the faces of all and any who would retaliate. The Negro stevedores and deckhands on steamboats or in city honky-tonks who thought he was a white man and believed it only the more strongly when he denied it. The white men who, when he said he was a Negro, believed that he lied in order to save his skin, or worse, from sheer besotment of sexual perversion. In either case the result the same. The man with body and limbs almost as light and delicate as a girl's given the first blow, usually unarmed and heedless of the numbers opposed to him, with that same fury and implacability and physical imperviousness to pain and punishment, neither cursin' nor pantin'. But laughing. So he showed Judith the license and took his wife, already far gone with the child, to the ruined cabin which he had chosen to repair, and installed her, kenneled her with a gesture perhaps, and returned to the house. And nobody to know what transpired that evening between him and Judith, in whatever carpetless room furnished with whatever chairs and such which they had not had to chop up and burn to cook food or for warmth, or maybe to heat water for illness from time to time, the woman who had been widowed before she had been a bride, the son of the man who had bereaved her, and a hereditary Negro concubine, who had not resented his black blood so much as he had denied the white, and this with a curious and outrageous exaggeration in which was inherent its own irrevocability, almost exactly as the demon himself might have done it. "Because there was love," Mr. Compson said. "There was that letter she brought and gave to your grandmother to keep." He, Quentin, could see it as plainly as he saw the one open upon the open textbook on the table before him, white in his father's dark hand against his linen leg in the September twilight, where the cigar smell, the wisteria smell, the fireflies drifted, thinking, "Yes, I have heard too much, I have been told too much, I have had to listen to too much, too long." Thinking, "Yes, almost exactly like father, that letter, and who to know what moral restoration she might have contemplated in the privacy of that house, that room, that night, what hurdling of iron old traditions, since she had seen almost everything else she had learned to call stable vanish like straws in a gale. She sitting there beside the lamp in a straight chair, erect, in the same calico save that the sunbonnet would be missing now, the head bare now, the once coal-black hair streaked with gray now, while he faced her, standing. He would not have sat, perhaps she would not even have asked him to, and the cold level voice would not be much louder than the sound of the lamp's flame. I was wrong, I admit it. I believed that there were things which still mattered just because they had mattered once. But I was wrong. Nothing matters but breath, breathing, to know and to be alive. And the child, the license, the paper, what about it? That paper is between you and one who is inescapably Negro. It can be put aside. No one will any more dare bring it up than any other prank of a young man in his wild youth. And as for the child, all right. Didn't my own father beget one, and he none the worse for it? We will even keep the woman and the child if you wish. They can stay here, and Clytie will... Watching him, staring at him yet not moving, immobile, erect, her hands folded motionless on her lap, hardly breathing as if he were some wild bird or beast which might take flight at the expansion and contraction of her nostrils or the movement of her breast. No, I will raise it, see that it does not need to have any name. You will neither have to see it again nor to worry. We will have General Compson sell some of the land. He will do it, and you can go. Into the north, the cities, where it will not matter even if... But they will not. They will not dare. I will tell them that you are Henry's son, and who could or would dare to dispute? And he standing there, looking at her or not looking at her, she cannot tell, since his face would be lowered. The still expressionless thin face, she watching him, not daring to move, her voice murmuring, clear enough and full enough, yet hardly reaching him. Charles, and he know Miss Sutphen. And she again, still without moving, not stirring so much as a muscle, as if she stood on the outside of the thicket into which she had cajoled the animal which she knew was watching her, though she could not see it, not quite cringing, not in any terror or even alarm, but in that restive light and incorrigibility of the free which would leave not even a print on the earth which lightly bore it. And she not daring to put out the hand with which she could have actually touched it, but instead just speaking to it, her voice soft and swooning, filled with that seduction, that celestial promise which is the female's weapon. Call me Aunt Judith, Charles. Yes, who to know if he said anything or nothing, turning, going out, she still sitting there, not moving, not stirring, watching him, still seeing him, penetrating the walls and darkness, too, to watch him walk back down the weedy lane between the deserted, collapsed cabins toward that one where his wife waited, treading the thorny and flint-paved path toward the Gethsemane which he had decreed and created for himself, where he had crucified himself and come down from his cross for a moment and now returned to it. Not your grandfather. He knew only what the town, the county, knew. That the strange little boy whom Clytie had used to watch and had taught to farm, who had sat, a grown man, in the justice's court that day with his head bandaged and one arm in a sling and the other in a handcuff, who had vanished and then returned with an authentic wife resembling something in a zoo, now farmed on shares a portion of the Sutton plantation, farmed it pretty well, with solitary and steady husbandry within his physical limitations, the body and limbs which still looked too light for the task which he had set for himself, who lived like a hermit in the cabin which he rebuilt, and where his son was presently born, who consorted with neither white nor black, Clytie did not watch him now, she did not need to, and who was not seen in Jefferson but 3 times during the next 4 years, and then to appear, be reported by the negroes who seemed to fear either him or Clytie or Judith, as being neither blind or violently drunk in the negro store district on Depot Street, where your grandfather would come and take him away, or if he were too drunk had become violent, the town officers, and keep him until his wife, the black gargoyle, could hitch the team back into the wagon and come, with nothing alive about her but her eyes and hands, and load him into it and take him home. So they did not even miss him from town at first. It was the county medical officer who told your grandfather that he had yellow fever, and that Judith had had him moved into the big house and was nursing him now, and now Judith had the disease too, and your grandfather told him to notify Miss Coldfield, and he, your grandfather, rode out there one day. He did not dismount. He sat his horse and called until Clytie looked down at him from one of the upper windows and told him they didn't need nothing. Within the week your grandfather learned that Clytie had been right, or was right now anyway, though it was Judith who died first. "Oh," Quentin said. Yes, he thought, too much, too long. Remembering how he had looked at the 5th grave and thought how whoever had buried Judith must have been afraid that the other dead would contract the disease from her, since her grave was at the opposite side of the enclosure, as far from the other 4 as the enclosure would permit, thinking, Father won't have to say think this time, because he knew who had ordered and bought that headstone before he read the inscription on it, thinking about, imagining what careful printed directions Judith must have roused herself, from delirium possibly, to write down for Clytie when she knew that she was going to die, and how Clytie must have lived during the next 12 years while she raised the child which had been born in the old slave cabin and scrimped and saved the money to finish paying out the stone on which Judith had paid his grandfather $100 24 years ago, and which, when his grandfather tried to refuse it, she, Clytie, set the rusty can full of nickels and dimes and frayed paper money on the desk and walked out of the office without a word. He had to brush the clinging cedar needles from this one also to read it, watching these letters also emerge beneath his hand, wondering quietly how they could have clung there, not have been blistered to ashes at the instant of contact with the harsh and unforgiving threat. Judith Coldfield Sutphen, daughter of Ellen Coldfield, born October 3, 1841, suffered the indignities and travails of this world for 42 years, 4 months, 9 days, and went to rest at last February 12, 1884. Pause, mortal, remember vanity and folly, and beware. Thinking, Quentin, yes, I didn't need to ask who invented that, put that one up. Thinking, yes, to too much, too long. I didn't need to listen then, but I had to hear it, and now I'm having to hear it all over again because he sounds just like Father. Beautiful lives, women do. In very breathing they draw meat and drink from some beautiful attenuation of unreality in which the shades and shapes of facts, of birth and bereavement, of suffering and bewilderment and despair, move with the substanceless decorum of lawn party charades, perfect in gesture and without significance or any ability to hurt. Miss Rosa ordered that one. She decreed that headstone of Judge Benbow. He had been the executor of her father's estate, appointed by no will since Mr. Coldfield left neither will nor estate except the house and the rifled shell of the store. So he appointed himself, elected himself, probably out of some conclave of neighbors and citizens, who came together to discuss her affairs and what to do with her after they realized that nothing under the sun, certainly no man nor committee of men, would ever persuade her to go back to her niece and brother-in-law. The same citizens and neighbors who left baskets of food on her doorstep at night, the dishes, the plates containing the food, the napkins which covered it, from which she never washed, but returned soiled to the empty basket and set the basket back on the same step where she had found it, as if to carry completely out the illusion that it had never existed, or at least that she had never touched, emptied it, had not come out and taken the basket up with that air which had nothing whatever of furtiveness in it, nor even defiance, who doubtless tasted the food, criticized its quality or cooking, chewed and swallowed it and felt it digest, yet still clung to that delusion, that calm, incorrigible insistence that that which all incontrovertible evidence tells her is so does not exist, as women can. That same self-deluding which declined to admit that the liquidation of the store had left her something, that she had been left anything but a complete pauper, who would not accept the actual money from the sale of the store from Judge Benbow, yet would accept the money's value, and after a few years overvalue, in a dozen ways, would use casual Negro boys who happened to pass the house, stopping them and commanding them to rake her yard, and they doubtless as aware as the town was that there would be no mention of pay from her, that they would not even see her again, though they knew she was watching them from behind the curtains of a window, but that Judge Benbow would pay them, would enter the stores and command objects from the shelves and showcases, exactly as she commanded that $200 headstone from Judge Benbow, and walk out of the store with them, who, with the same aberrant cunning which would not wash the dishes and napkins from the baskets, declined to have any discussion of her affairs with Benbow, since she must have known that the sums which she had received from him must have years ago overbalanced. He, Benbow, had in his office a portfolio, a fat one, with Estate of Good Hugh Coldfield, Private, written across it in indelible ink. After the judge died, his son Percy opened it. It was filled with racing forms and cancelled betting tickets on horses whose very bones were no man knew where now, which had won and lost races on the Memphis track 40 years ago, and a ledger, a careful tabulation in the judge's hand, each entry indicating the date and the horse's name and his wager, and whether he won or lost, and another one showing how for 40 years he had put each winning and an amount equal to each loss to that mythical account. Whatever the store had brought. But you were not listening because you knew it already, had learned, absorbed it already without the medium of speech somehow, from having been born and living beside it, with it, as children will and do. So that what your father was saying did not tell you anything so much as it struck, word by word, the resonant strings of remembering. Who had been here before, seen these graves more than once in the ramblin' expeditions of boyhood whose aim was more than the mere huntin' of game. Just as you had seen the old house, too, been familiar with how it would look before you even saw it, became large enough to go out there one day with 4 or 5 other boys of your size and age, and dare one another to evoke the ghost, since it would have to be haunted, could not but be haunted, although it had stood there empty and unthreatening for 26 years, and nobody to meet or report any ghost, until the wagon full of strangers moving from Arkansas tried to stop and spend the night in it, and something happened before they could begin to unload the wagon even. What they did not or could not or would not tell, but which had them back in the wagon and the mules going back down the drive at a gallop, all in about 10 minutes, not to stop until they reached Jefferson. The rotten shell with its sagging portico and scaling walls, its sagging blinds and blank-shuttered windows, set in the middle of the domain which had reverted to the state and had been bought and sold and bought and sold again and again and again. No, you were not listening. You didn't have to. Then the dogs stirred, rose. You looked up, and sure enough, just as your father had said he would, Luster had halted the mule and the 2 horses in the rain about 50 yards from the cedars, sitting there with his knees drawn up under the toe-sack and enclosed by the cloudy vapor of the steaming animals as though he were looking at you and your father out of some lugubrious and painless purgatory. "Come on in out of the rain, Luster," your father said. "I won't let the old colonel hurt you." "Y'all come on, let's go home," Luster said. "Ain't no more hunting today." "We'll get wet," your father said. "I'll tell you what, we'll ride on over to that old house. We can keep good and dry there." But Luster didn't budge, sitting there in the rain and inventing reasons not to go to the house. That the roof would leak, or that you would all 3 catch cold with no fire, or that you would all get so wet before you reached it that the best thing to do would be to go straight home. and your father laughing at Luster, but you not laughing so much because even though you were not black like Luster was, you were not any older. And you and Luster had both been there that day when the five of you, the five boys all of an age, began daring one another to enter the house long before you reached it, coming up from the rear into the old street of the slave quarters, a jungle of sumac and persimmon and briars and honeysuckle, and the rotting piles of what had once been log walls and stone chimneys and shingle roofs among the undergrowth, except one, that one. You coming up to it, you didn't see the old woman at all at first because you were watching the boy, the Jim Bond, the hulking, slack-mouthed, saddle-colored boy a few years older and bigger than you were, in patched and faded yet quite clean shirt and overalls too small for him, working in the garden patch beside the cabin. So you didn't even know she was there until all of you started and whirled as one and found her watching you from a chair tilted back against the cabin wall. A little dried-up woman not much bigger than a monkey and who might have been any age up to 10,000 years, in faded voluminous skirts and an immaculate head rag, her bare coffee-colored feet wrapped around the chair rung like monkeys do, smoking a clay pipe and watching you with eyes like two shoe buttons buried in the myriad wrinkles of her coffee-colored face, who just looked at you and said without even removing the pipe and in a voice almost like a white woman's, "What do you want?" And after a moment one of you said nothing, and then you were all running without knowing which of you began to run first, nor why, since you were not scared, back across the fallow and rain-gutted and briar-choked old fields, until you came to the old rotting snake fence and crossed it, hurled yourselves over it, and then the earth, the land, the sky and trees and woods looked different again, all right again.
"Yes," Quentin said.
"And that was the one Luster was talking about now," Shreve said. "And your father watching you again because he hadn't heard the name before, hadn't even thought that he must have a name that day when you saw him in the vegetable patch. And you said, 'Who? Jim what?' And Luster said, 'Das him, bright-colored boy what stay with that old woman.' And your father still watching you, and you said, 'Spell it.' And Luster said, 'That's a lawyer word. What they puts you under when the law catches you. I dispels reading words.' And that was him, the name Bond now, and he wouldn't care about that, who had inherited what he was from his mother and only what he could never have been from his father. And if your father had asked him if he was Charles Bond's son, he not only would not have known either, he wouldn't have cared. And if you had told him he was, it would have touched and then vanished from what you, not he, would have had to call his mind long before it could have set up any reaction at all, either of pride or pleasure, anger or grief.'
'Yes,' Quentin said.
'And that he lived in that cabin behind the haunted house for 26 years, he and the old woman who must be more than 70 now, yet who had no white hair under that head rag, whose flesh had not sagged but looked instead like she had grown old up to a certain point just like normal people do, then had stopped, and instead of turning gray and soft, she had begun to shrink, so that the skin of her face and hands broke into a million tiny crosshair wrinkles, and her body just grew smaller and smaller, like something being shrunk in a furnace, like the Bornese do their captured heads. Who might well have been the ghost if one was ever needed, if anybody had so little else to do as to prowl around the house, which there was not, if there could have been anything in it to protect from prowlers, which there was not, if there had been any one of them left to hide or need concealment in it, which there was not. And yet this old gal, this Aunt Rosa, told you that someone was hiding out there, and you said it was Clytie or Jim Bond, and she said no. And you said it would have to be because the demon was dead, and Judith was dead, and Bond was dead, and Henry gone so far he hadn't even left a grave. And she said no, and so you went out there, drove the 12 miles at night in a buggy, and you found Clytie and Jim Bond both in it, and you said, 'You see?' And she, the Aunt Rosa, still said no, and so you went on. And there was?"
"Yes."
"Wait, then," Shreve said. "For God's sake, wait."